Thank you for being an amazing supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, home to the history of the Caribbeans. We're excited to have you as a valued member of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes, comments, and reviews mean so much to us. They help us reach a wider audience and inspire us to keep sharing these incredible stories. With new episodes released daily, your feedback plays a crucial role in shaping our content and making it even better. Your dedication and enthusiasm drive our mission to document and celebrate the rich history of the Caribbean. We're deeply grateful for your support. Today, we're thrilled to present Honduras Episode 3, a captivating story tracing the journey from the island's earliest settlers to the present day. So sit back, relax, and join us as we guide you through this fascinating chapter in Caribbean history. Enjoy the journey. Chapter 9, The Narco-State and Economic Crisis, 1980s-2000s. Part 1, The Aftermath of the Cold War, 1980s-1990s, A Nation in Ruins. The Cold War had ended, but for the people of Honduras, there was no peace. The dictators were gone. The death squads had disbanded. The military had stepped back. And yet, the country was worse off than ever. Honduras had spent decades as a battlefield for foreign interests. A place where American money funded dictatorships, where the CIA trained assassins, where civil liberties had been traded for empty promises of stability. Now, as the 1990s began, the people faced a new war, a war not fought with armies, but with hunger, poverty, and crime. The economy, once propped up by foreign aid, collapsed. The government, once controlled by generals, became corrupt beyond repair. And the streets, once patrolled by military forces, were taken over by something even deadlier. Because as one empire fell, another rose from the ashes. And this time, it was the cartels who ruled. Part 2, The Birth of the Narco-State, 1990s-2000s, The Rise of Drug Cartels. In the shadows of the crumbling government, drug traffickers saw an opportunity. For years, Honduras had been a quiet link in the global drug trade, a stopover point where shipments of cocaine from Colombia and heroin from Mexico passed through on their way to the United States. But now, as the state weakened, the cartels grew bolder. The Cali and Medellin cartels of Colombia expanded their operations into Honduran territory. The Sinaloa and Gulf cartels of Mexico established alliances with local criminal groups. The Honduran elite, desperate to maintain their wealth, looked the other way, or worse, became part of the trade themselves. Entire rural communities were swallowed by the narco economy. Farms that once grew corn and coffee were converted into coca fields. Ports that once exported bananas now smuggled drugs by the ton. Politicians who once served the military now served the drug lords. And soon, even the police and army were under cartel control. Honduras was no longer just a country. It was a business. A narco state, where violence, corruption, and money ruled above all else. Part 3. The Gangs Take Over, The Rise of MS-13 and Barrio-18, 1990s-2000s. If the cartels controlled the trade, the gangs controlled the streets. In the 1990s, as the United States cracked down on organized crime, it began mass deportations of Central American criminals. Thousands of Hondurans who had spent their youth in the gang-infested streets of Los Angeles were now sent back. Not as troubled youth, but as trained killers, hardened by American gang wars. They brought with them a new kind of violence, a brutal, relentless war that transformed Honduras into one of the most dangerous countries on earth. Two gangs rose to power, locked in an unending war for control. MS-13 Mara Salvatrucha, a gang known for its ruthless executions, drug trafficking, and extortion rackets. Barrio-18, 18th Street Gang, a gang that specialized in kidnappings, armed robberies, and massacres of rival groups. The cities of San Pedro Sula, Tegucigalpa, and La Ceiba became war zones. Buses were hijacked, their passengers executed for refusing to pay gang fees. Children were recruited as foot soldiers, trained to kill before they could even read. Entire neighborhoods became off-limits, controlled by gang warlords who ruled with an iron fist. The police? Bought and paid for. The government? Too weak to fight back. And the people? Trapped in a never-ending nightmare. Honduras was now not just a narco state. It was a gang state. Part 4, The Great Migration, A Nation Flees, 1990s-2000s. For many Hondurans, there was only one escape, to flee north. By the early 2000s, entire families abandoned their homes, making the treacherous journey through Guatemala and Mexico, risking everything to reach the U.S. border. They fled because the economy was collapsing, there were no jobs. Gangs were killing at will, there was no safety. The government was corrupt, there was no justice. Thousands died along the way. Some were kidnapped by cartels in Mexico. Some were abandoned in the desert, left to perish under the scorching sun. Some were detained at the U.S. border, only to be sent back to the violence they had fled. And those who did make it to America? They found a new struggle, one of discrimination, of poverty, of a government that saw them not as refugees, but as criminals. The cycle was endless. Honduras had become a nation of exiles. And those left behind? They were forced to survive by any means necessary. Part 5. The Government's Failure, Corruption and Betrayal, 2000s present. As the cartels grew richer, as the gangs took over the streets, as Hondurans fled in record numbers, the government did nothing. Or worse, they profited from the chaos. By the early 2000s, Honduras had become one of the most corrupt nations in the world. Presidents were caught taking bribes from drug lords. Police chiefs were exposed as cartel informants. Elections were rigged, ensuring that only the corrupt remained in power. Every attempt at reform was met with violence. Every call for justice was answered with assassinations. And the people, they learned not to trust anyone. Not the politicians. Not the military. Not even the police. Honduras was no longer just a country in crisis. It was a nation on the brink of collapse. And yet, the people endured. Because for all the corruption, for all the violence, for all the betrayals, there was still hope. Hope that one day, the chains would be broken. Hope that one day, Honduras would belong to its people once again. But first, a new storm was coming. A storm that would shake Honduras to its very core. And the battle for the future was only just beginning. Chapter 10, Democracy and Fragile Stability, 2000 present. Part 1, The Illusion of Democracy, 2000-2009, Corruption in High Places. The new millennium was supposed to bring change. Honduras had endured decades of military rule, Cold War conflicts, and cartel violence. The people hoped that democracy, no matter how fragile, would finally bring stability. But democracy is only as strong as those who uphold it. And in Honduras, the system was already broken before it began. Elections were held. Presidents were chosen. Laws were passed. But behind the curtain of democracy, the same old elite controlled everything. The military generals still whispered in the president's ear. The cartels still filled the pockets of politicians. The United States still dictated economic and security policies from afar. Every election was tainted by fraud. Every president promised reform, only to become another pawn in the game. And as the people struggled with poverty, violence, and unemployment, their leaders lived in luxury, untouched by the suffering outside their palace gates. For the people of Honduras, democracy had not saved them. It had simply changed the name of the oppressor. Part 2, The 2009 Coup, The Day Democracy Died Again. On June 28, 2009, Hondurans woke up to the sound of gunfire and helicopters overhead. That morning, soldiers stormed the presidential palace. They dragged President Manuel Zelaya from his bed at gunpoint, still in his pajamas, and threw him onto a military plane bound for Costa Rica. By the time the sun rose, Honduras had no president. What had happened? Zelaya, a left-leaning leader, had pushed for constitutional reforms that threatened the elite. The military, backed by the country's business class, accused him of trying to extend his rule. The Supreme Court, Congress, and the military all turned against him overnight. And just like that, democracy was shattered. For the first time in decades, the world watched as Honduras fell into political chaos. People took to the streets. Protesters were beaten, arrested, and killed. The military declared martial law. And as the international community condemned the coup, the United States remained silent. Because behind closed doors, Washington saw Zelaya as a threat, too friendly with leftist governments like Venezuela, too willing to challenge American influence. And so, the coup was allowed to stand. Zelaya never returned to power. And Honduras was left in the hands of those who had orchestrated his removal. A coalition of corrupt officials, military leaders, and corporate elites who had no interest in democracy, only control. Part 3, The Decade of Violence, 2010-2020, A Nation Under Siege. The 2010s were the darkest years in modern Honduran history. With political instability came lawlessness. With lawlessness came violence, and with violence came death. Between 2010 and 2015, Honduras became the murder capital of the world. Gangs controlled entire neighborhoods. Police dared not enter. Political assassinations became common. Journalists, activists, and opposition leaders were killed in broad daylight. Corruption reached new levels. Drug cartels openly bought and sold politicians. The government's response? More militarization. The military police, created to fight gangs, became just another source of terror. Arbitrary arrests. Torture in detention centers. Extrajudicial killings of suspected criminals. And the United States, always watching, continued to fund the very forces that oppressed the people. By 2015, over 500,000 Hondurans had fled the country, joining the migrant caravans heading north. For many, the choice was simple. Stay, and risk being murdered. Or leave, and risk dying on the journey. Either way, Honduras offered them no future. Part 4. The rigged elections of 2017, a stolen future. If the 2009 coup had destroyed faith in democracy, the 2017 elections buried it forever. President Juan Orlando Hernandez, a man accused of drug trafficking, election fraud, and human rights violations, ran for re-election, despite the fact that the Constitution forbade it. The election results were delayed for days. When the count resumed, Hernandez had mysteriously overtaken his opponent. International observers declared the election fraudulent. And yet, the Supreme Electoral Tribunal declared him the winner. The people erupted in protest. Hundreds of thousands filled the streets. Roads were blocked, businesses shut down. The police and military responded with live bullets. Dozens were killed. Hundreds were arrested and tortured. And once again, the United States endorsed the regime, refusing to condemn the fraud. Honduras had officially become a dictatorship in all but name. And with Hernandez in power, the nation plunged even deeper into corruption and violence. Part 5. The Fall of Juan Orlando Hernandez, Justice or a Cover-Up? 2022 Present. In 2022, something extraordinary happened. For the first time, a sitting Honduran president was arrested and extradited to the United States. Juan Orlando Hernandez, the man who had ruled Honduras with an iron grip for nearly a decade, was charged with drug trafficking and money laundering. The U.S. government, which had once propped him up, now called him a central figure in the cocaine trade. The people cheered, believing that justice had finally arrived. But many remained skeptical. After all, Hernandez had worked with the U.S. government for years. He had been America's closest ally in the region. So why now? Some believed the U.S. had turned on him only because he had outlived his usefulness. Others feared that his removal was just another illusion, a distraction from the deeper corruption that remained. Because even though one man had fallen, the system that created him remained untouched. Part 6, a new beginning, or more of the same. Present-day future. As Honduras moves forward, the battle for the soul of the nation continues. A new government is in power, but corruption remains. Violence has decreased, but gangs still control entire regions. The people want change, but trust in the system is broken. For decades, Honduras has been a country at war with itself, a land of hope and despair, of dreams and betrayals. The future is uncertain, but one truth remains. The people of Honduras have never stopped fighting. They have survived dictatorships, military coups, drug wars, and stolen elections. And no matter what comes next, they will endure again. Because history has shown them that nothing is given. Everything must be fought for. And one day, Honduras will belong to its people once again. Chapter 11, Indigenous and Afro-Honduran Identity, A Legacy of Survival and Resistance. Part 1, The First People, the Indigenous Nations of Honduras. Long before the arrival of Columbus, before the Spanish plundered the land, before foreign corporations turned the soil into a battlefield of profit, Honduras belonged to the first people. Nations that had thrived for centuries, their civilizations built upon the mountains, jungles, and rivers that still whisper their stories. They were not a single tribe. They were many, each with their own language, traditions, and way of life. The Lenca, fierce warriors of the western highlands, defenders of their sacred lands. The Pesh, keepers of the forests, their spirits woven into the rivers and trees. The Taliapan, masters of survival, hidden deep within the mountains, untouched by time. The Chorti Maya, descendants of the great Maya civilization, guardians of ancient knowledge. The Tawaka, river people, their canoes gliding silently through the jungle waters. For centuries, these nations thrived. They hunted in the dense forests, fished in the Caribbean waters, and built temples that touched the sky. Their gods lived in the rain, in the sun, in the earth beneath their feet. But then the ships arrived, and the world changed forever. Part 2, The Invasion, The Struggle Against Spanish Rule, 1502-1700s. The Spanish came with steel and fire. At first, the indigenous nations met them with curiosity. The strangers, pale-skinned and heavily armed, spoke of a distant king, a foreign god, a new world order. But when the Spaniards began taking their land, their gold, and their people, the indigenous nations rose in defiance. The Lenca fought the hardest. Under Lempira, their greatest warrior, they waged war against the Spanish in the mountains of western Honduras. For years, they held their ground, refusing to submit. But treachery won where steel could not. The Spanish, unable to defeat Lempira in battle, sent emissaries with false promises of peace. And when he met with them to discuss a truce, they shot him down in cold blood. With their leader dead, the resistance crumbled. One by one, the other indigenous nations fell under Spanish control. Their lands were stolen. Their gods were forbidden. Their people were enslaved. The Spanish believed they had erased them. But they were wrong, because survival was woven into the soul of the indigenous people, and they would not disappear so easily. Part 3, The Arrival of the Afro-Hondurans. A new struggle begins, 1600s, 1800s. As the Spanish tightened their grip on Honduras, they realized something. The indigenous population was dying. Disease, war, and enslavement had wiped out entire villages. And so, the Spanish turned to a new source of labor, Africa. Torn from their homes, packed into slave ships, and sold into bondage, the first enslaved Africans arrived in Honduras in the 1600s. But not all arrived in chains. In 1635, a slave ship bound for the Caribbean wrecked off the coast of St. Vincent, stranding a group of Africans who escaped into the wild. There, they met the Arawak people, an indigenous Caribbean tribe, and over time, their bloodlines, cultures, and languages intertwined. The result? The Garifuna people, a new nation, forged in resistance and survival, who would one day arrive on the shores of Honduras, bringing with them a culture unlike any other. Part 4, The Garifuna Arrival, A People Without a Homeland, 1797 present. The Garifuna were a threat. They were free people in a world where freedom was dangerous. The British, who now ruled the island of St. Vincent, saw them as rebels, warriors who refused to be enslaved, who fought back against colonial rule. And so, in 1797, they were exiled, placed on ships and abandoned along the coast of Honduras. They had no homeland, no nation to call their own. But what they did have was each other. And so, they built new villages along the Caribbean shores, from Trujillo to La Ceiba, from Tila to Puerto Cortez. They spoke their own language. They sang their own songs. They danced to the drums of their ancestors. And though the world around them tried to erase them, they held on to their identity. Even today, Garifuna culture remains one of the most vibrant and unique in the world, a blend of African rhythm, Caribbean spirit, and Honduran resilience. But their struggle was not over. Because even in the modern age, both the Garifuna and indigenous Hondurans continue to fight for their land, their culture, and their very existence. Part 5, The Modern Struggle, Land, Identity, and Survival, 1900s present. Even after centuries of survival, the indigenous and Afro-Honduran communities still face new battles. Their land is being stolen once again, this time by corporations, drug cartels, and corrupt governments. Their languages are dying as Spanish replaces their native tongues. Their traditions are under attack as modern industries push them further into poverty and isolation. In the 21st century, the fight continues. The Lenca people fight against megadams that flood their ancestral lands. The Garifuna communities resist tourism developments that push them out of their villages. The Taliapan and Pesh peoples battle against illegal logging that destroys the forests they have lived in for centuries. One of the most tragic symbols of this struggle was Berta Cáceres, a Lenca environmental activist who stood against the powerful forces that sought to destroy her people's land. She fought against corporations. She fought against corruption. She fought for the right to exist. And in 2016, she was assassinated. A message to all who would dare to resist. But even in death, her fight lives on. Because the spirit of Lempira, of the Garifuna exiles, of the first people of Honduras, still burns today. Part 6, the future, a culture that refuses to die. Honduras has tried to erase them. The world has tried to forget them. But the indigenous and Afro-Honduran people are still here. They are in the mountains, in the forests, in the waves of the Caribbean. They are in the stories, in the drums, in the language whispered between generations. And no matter what comes next, they will endure. Because they always have. And they always will. Chapter 12, Honduras in the Global Era, A Nation at the Crossroads. A Storytelling Narrative. Part 1, The Weight of History, Entering the 21st Century. Honduras entered the 21st century not with triumph, but with baggage. It carried the scars of colonial exploitation, the wounds of military rule, the deep fractures of drug violence and corruption. It had fought for independence, only to fall under the control of foreign corporations. It had struggled for democracy, only to have its leaders ousted in military coups. It had endured Cold War politics, only to become a narco-state and a battleground for gang wars. And now, as it stepped into a new era, Honduras was forced to ask itself a question. Would it continue to be a pawn in the hands of greater powers? Or would it finally reclaim its future? The answer would not come easily, because the challenges ahead were greater than ever before. Part 2, The Globalized Economy, Who Really Owns Honduras? The age of empires was over, but colonialism had never truly died. Instead, it had changed its name. Now, instead of Spanish conquistadors and American fruit companies, Honduras was at the mercy of global corporations, international banks, and foreign investors. The mining industry, controlled by Canadian and U.S. companies, stripped the mountains of their gold and silver. The palm oil plantations, owned by multinational agribusinesses, replaced once fertile farmlands. The garment factories, operated by foreign investors, turned Honduras into a center for cheap labor exports. The workers were still poor. The land was still exploited. The government still served outside interests before its own people. Globalization had promised economic progress, but for most Hondurans, it had delivered only deeper inequality. The rich became richer. The poor became desperate. And the nation remained trapped in a cycle of dependence. Part 3, The Migrant Crisis, A Nation That Flees. If there was one defining image of Honduras in the global era, it was the migrant caravans. By the 2010s, entire families began walking north, fleeing poverty, violence, and corruption. Young men, escaping gang recruitment. Mothers, trying to protect their children from death threats. Farmers, watching their land wither under corporate control. They traveled on foot, thousands of miles, through the jungles of Guatemala, across the deserts of Mexico, toward a border that did not want them. And when they reached the United States, they were met with walls, detention centers, and deportations. To the outside world, they were refugees. To some, they were criminals. But in reality, they were the price of a broken system. A system that had left no future for them in their own homeland. A system that forced them to choose exile over survival. Part 4, The Drug War, The Global Demand for Cocaine. Even as its people fled, Honduras remained valuable to the global economy. Not for its bananas. Not for its minerals. But for something far more dangerous. Cocaine. By the 2000s, Honduras had become one of the most important trafficking routes in the world. 85% of cocaine destined for the U.S. passed through Central America. Honduran politicians were caught working directly with cartels. Entire rural communities were controlled by narco militias. The police were corrupted. The military was compromised. And the United States, while condemning the drug trade, continued to funnel money into the very security forces that protected the traffickers. For many Hondurans, the message was clear. Crime was the only way to survive. Because the cartels offered what the government never had. Jobs. Protection. A way out of poverty. And so, the cycle of violence and impunity deepened, making Honduras one of the most dangerous countries in the world. A nation where justice was bought and sold, and where the global demand for cocaine dictated the fate of millions. Part 5, Climate Change and Environmental Struggles, A Battle for the Future. Even as crime and corruption dominated the headlines, another crisis was brewing. One that threatened the very survival of Honduras itself. Climate change. Hurricanes became more frequent, devastating crops and displacing communities. Deforestation wiped out ancient forests, leaving the land vulnerable to landslides and drought. Rising sea levels began to swallow coastal villages, forcing entire populations to move inland. And once again, the indigenous and Garifuna communities were on the front lines of the struggle. They fought against mega dams that flooded their ancestral lands, mining projects that poisoned their water, illegal logging that destroyed the forests they had protected for centuries. For them, the battle was not just about the environment. It was about survival. Because if their land was lost, their culture would die with it. And once again, the government sided with corporations over its own people. Activists were murdered. Protests were violently repressed. Laws were passed that favored the rich while the poor were left to suffer. It was a battle that was not yet lost, but every day, the fight became harder. Part 6. The Fight for Change, Hope in a Broken System. Despite everything, Honduras has not given up. Even in the darkest times, there are those who resist. Grassroots organizations continue to demand justice and reform. New generations of activists fight for indigenous rights, women's rights, and environmental protection. Honduran artists, musicians, and storytellers keep their culture alive, reminding the world that their identity will not be erased. And in recent years, there have been signs of hope. Corrupt politicians have been arrested, some even extradited to the United States for drug trafficking. Human rights abuses have gained international attention, forcing the government to answer for its crimes. New leaders have emerged, promising to break the cycle of corruption. But promises are not enough, because history has shown that Honduras has been betrayed before. The question remains, can the people take back their country? Can they finally break free from foreign control, political corruption, and the grip of organized crime? Can Honduras reclaim its future? The answer has not yet been written. But the people of Honduras have always been fighters. And as long as they continue to resist, to dream, and to demand justice, there is still hope.